Welcome to Council Tapes, an interview feature of the American Association of Christian Counselors. Today, our guest is noted author, seminar host, and clinical psychologist from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Dr. Diane Langberg, and our topic, Lessons Learned in the Therapist's Chair. Now, here is our host, Dr. Tim Clinton, Executive Vice President of the American Association of Christian Counselors.
We're going to break away in this particular tape from our traditional interview and take you to a regional conference in Cincinnati in the fall of 1996. Dr. Diane Langberg gave an address there that we believe was one of the most powerful addresses you've heard in a long, long time. I believe you're going to find in this tape nuggets of truth and encouragement that are going to really jumpstart your 1997. By the way, if you've not been to a regional conference, you really need to consider being a part of an AACC regional. And don't forget, Dallas 1997. That's November 5 through 8. Mark your calendar right now for AACC's very first World Conference on Christian Counseling. Gary and I hope that every one of you listening will join us in Dallas for that powerful event. It's going to be jam-packed with interesting speakers, music, praise and worship, a time that I think will bless your heart. Well, let's go now to Dr. Diane Langberg, and blessings to you in this new year.
Working this past year on this book for Tyndall House, which is a book on counseling survivors of sexual abuse, has caused a lot of reflection on my part over the years and my work as a therapist. And it dawned on me recently while I was reflecting back that it has been this fall 25 years since I saw my first client. And I would like to tell you that it was not an auspicious beginning. I was a master's student in psychology at a large city university and had been granted a graduate assistantship in the University Counseling Center. And I was a semester into my studies and finally granted the longed-for permission to begin seeing students. My first client was a male undergraduate at the university. He was terrified. I was eager to begin. How hard could it be? He was going to come in and be sad about something, which was my first wrong assumption. He would begin to talk, my second wrong assumption. I was going to listen compassionately, and he would feel better, my third and fourth. 5 minutes into the session, I was more terrified than he. I found myself sitting across from a 19-year-old male who was hysterical, utterly inarticulate, and blatantly suicidal. His panic and emotional thrashing about consumed him, and in 5 minutes had swallowed me up as well. And I, being very logical, chose the most brilliant option for any therapist when faced with blatant suicidality. I left. I did. I said, you wait right here, I'll be right back. I think the poor guy was so utterly startled by my reaction, it never occurred to him that he could walk out of the office. I ran down the hall, I pounded on my mentor's door, he was in session with his own client, and said he needed to come right now. And he said perhaps he could finish his own session. I thought that was a ludicrous idea. I needed him right now. And he proceeded to very calmly exit from his own client and turn to the needs of his trainee and her client. And I sat on the floor of my office that day and watched my mentor give a very terrified young man some hope. I was 22. Several months after that, I saw my first survivor of sexual abuse, which at that time was an evil that was utterly foreign to me. A year later, in the same University Counseling Center, I'd been working with a young woman who'd been depressed. I'd come to care for her very deeply and came to work one morning to the news that she had been brutally murdered the night before with the cord of her hairdryer. And so it has gone. There have literally been hundreds of them. They have struck me dumb with the depths of their suffering. They brought me stories of evil and pain that have been incomprehensible to me. They have highlighted in very bright colors my own failures and inadequacies. They have challenged me, frustrated me, loved me, hated me, and enriched my life beyond words. The young woman who fled down the hall in a panic is gone. I am glad. She brought an eagerness to her work that still stands. and a heart that believed in the significance of individuals and their stories. She did not know very much, however, about how to be with people when they are suffering. And getting to know, in very profound and unusual ways over these years, this wonderful and complex creature who is created in the image of God has been the challenge of my life. I love what I do, and I hope that I can stand here after 50 years of walking in and among human stuff and say the same thing. I've learned many things over the years, and so what I'd like to do this morning is just offer you some thoughts about this process we call counseling, in hopes that my experiences will assist and enrich you in the work that you do. Oswald Chambers, who is a very favorite author of mine, talks about having staying power in the alarm moments of others' lives. Staying power was clearly something I lacked 25 years ago. It is something I have acquired some measure of over time. And so as we consider today just a little bit about what counseling is, what our clients are like, and who we as counselors are, I hope that you will leave with a solid foundation for how to stand firm when the noise and the chaos and the pain are loud and seemingly vast. Now, if we're going to do something well, we need to understand it. If you want to play tennis well, you need to know that it is not simply enough to just get the ball over the net. You need to know how to hit the ball. You need to know not just that there is a forehand and a backhand, but you also need to have someone walk you through the proper position and sequence for each segment. If you're going to do counseling well, you must understand it. Now, one level of that understanding concerns the skills that are required, and they are, of course, a very crucial aspect to effective counseling. Another level of understanding comes from grappling with the theories. As we study theories, we get new perspectives and ideas on what we do. However, I have found that there are many things, very crucial things, about the nature of counseling that most people never talk about. They are characteristics that I think we need to reflect on and grapple with if we're really to understand what it is that we do. And I happen to think that if we do not understand these characteristics, then our skills, no matter how well honed, will fall short in the alarm moments of others' lives. And so I would like to first lay out for you some of the characteristics that no one else will tell you about. The first one is that therapy is ambiguous in nature. Now, those in research would be very upset, I know, to hear me say that. And they would make a case for demonstrating that therapy is measurable and so forth. And they would be right. However, interactions between human beings are often ambiguous. Someone brings you a problem. Chances are it's not the real problem. In fact, the odds are good they don't even know what the real problem is. They come expecting a quick fix. There is no quick fix. There's no quick fix for the assumed problem, and there's no quick fix for the real problem. They want to feel better. They're not even sure what that means. They want answers. All you have are questions. In essence, you see, we have two people shut up in a room behind a closed door on a weekly basis, probably talking about the wrong thing, with at least one of them looking for something that doesn't exist. Therapy is also about change. Now, they do tell us that in school, but what they forget to mention often is that change makes people very nervous. Change requires massive effort. And not only that, but when one person decides to expend all that effort and begins to change, they end up making everyone else in their world mad. Not usually considered a desirable therapeutic outcome. It makes change very threatening. And so that means we often have people coming to us to help them do something they find out they really don't want to do. And of course, not only is change in the wings for the client, they do forget to mention that it is also there for the counselor. A perfect stranger walks into your room with a story yet untold. This person and their story will impact you. They will take you places you've never been and often don't want to go. But you cannot let yourself down into another person's life without change. You cannot be truly present to things like abuse or violence or death or rage or darkness without it affecting you. And so you, the one who is supposed to have staying power, will find yourself changing. You will be hit by surprises and crises, and you will be thrown by the things that humans do to one another behind closed doors. Therapy is also about repetition. You say it, and you say it again. You live it out, and it's still questioned. You cannot confront the debilitating effects of incest without experiencing this. You speak truth, and you watch it swallowed up by a sea of lies. Over and over again, you rework the ground of trust, only to have someone turn around and say, "Is it still true? Are you trustworthy over here also?" And so again, you must return and restate and rework what you thought was clear. Therapy means living with silence. Now, you and I do not usually like silence when we're in the presence of other people. And when it happens, we feel obligated to fill it up. But I have found that pain brings silence, because often suffering is so great there are no words. Trauma silences. Death silences. The psalmist says, "I am shut up and I cannot come forth." To sit with suffering is to sit with others who are shut up and unable to come forth. And how hard for us to let that silence be, or to know when to break into it and when to say something. Therapy means tears, sometimes wrenching sobs. We tend to respond by handing out tissues, which is often a subtle hint that the crying should be over by now. We prefer human beings with clean faces. We feel awkward with sobs that can be heard by our colleagues down the hall, and we sit uneasily in the face of unadulterated terror and pain. It seems so uncivilized. We are uncertain as to whether it really is okay for people to act like that in our offices. Maybe that would be best done home alone when no one else is around. Therapy means waiting, a forgotten thing in days of fax machines and microwaves. Waiting for a thought to bubble through the surface of a confused and tormented mind. Waiting for an oft-repeated truth to penetrate a darkened mind. Waiting while somebody stutters through a pain-filled memory that is so torturous their speech is debilitated. Or waiting while you watch a spouse slowly decide to reach across a huge chasm toward the one from whom they have been alienated for years. Therapy is also about complexity. It's tangled and knotty. It means sitting with no clue, no vision, no clarity about what is really going on in front of you. You hear the words, you know what the words mean, but you also know that the words have nothing to do with what you're seeing. You pick up one thread and 12 others are connected. You try to separate one out so you can actually get somewhere, but if you pull too hard, the whole tangled mess will shatter into pieces. Ambiguity, change, silence, tears, repetition, waiting, and complexity. Anybody want a job? Stop and think about those characteristics for a minute in the light of what you know about human beings and about yourself in particular. These are not things to which we are drawn. These are things from which we run. The only one we might like is change, but generally we prefer it to occur in other people rather than in ourselves. And so here we are, engaged daily, even hourly, in a process that is characterized by things that most of us are uncomfortable with and some of us are afraid of. Now, not only have I observed some of the characteristics of this process called counseling, I've also learned some things about the clients who enter into that process with us. As a rule, and I think you would agree, people do not come to us for the purpose of sharing their happiness and stability with us. They come during the alarm moments of their lives. Now, if you have ever had that wonderful experience of accidentally setting off a burglar alarm, you have a little flavor of what your clients are experiencing when they pick up the phone for the first time or they walk into your office for the first time. There's a lot of noise and chaos in their lives. They don't remember what to do. codes that were easily recalled or forgotten. They're afraid. They feel like they're in danger. Something is wrong. They want somebody to help. They just want the noise to stop. They want the fear to subside. They want to feel safe. They want to be able to think again. If people are going to seek you out during alarm moments, one of the things they will bring you is their noise. They will walk into your room and bring anger and rage and violence and sobbing and ranting and terror and anxiety and obsessions that won't quit. And not only will they bring those things, they may reenact them with you. And you become then the recipient for anger and accusations and fear and obsessions or seductions. A lot must be learned. A lot must be grown up in us if we are to have staying power at such times. People will also bring you their history. They take it with them wherever they go. History is a thing we cannot get rid of. It just comes with living in time. There was a yesterday. Each of us had one. And it influences us today. Its sway is probably more profound during the alarm moments, because when chaos breaks out, what we do is we fall back on what we know and have practiced. And so the shaping influences of violence or sexual abuse or alcoholism or neglect and abandonment are clearly seen when the well-kept veneer is shattered by chaos. People will bring you their inabilities, their inadequacies, and their failures. They can't think. They can't remember. They don't have words, so they can't speak. They don't know what to call their feelings, or they don't feel. They've blown up their lives. They've quit. They're afraid. They don't know how to do something. Nobody taught them. They have no hope. I'm the director of a group practice outside Philadelphia, and every once in a while, when all of us feel like we've been on a roller coaster ride and are feeling simultaneously overwhelmed, we suggest to the office manager that we would please like her to go out and solicit us some clients who are happy, stable, and have no problems. But the fact of the matter is, you see, that if you and I are going to sit ourselves down in a chair and announce that we do counseling, then people will often bring us the worst of themselves. And so we have an ambiguous, silent, repetitive, tearful world filled with alarmed people who often by word and by deed bring us the worst of who they are. It is a fearsome challenge to live on a daily basis with the things that cause such discomfort in us as human beings and endure. Now, there's a third significant piece in this process called counseling, and that is, of course, the person of the therapist. If we consider counseling simply within the parameters of the seen world, the counselor is the tool. It is our voices that are heard, our expressions that are read, our movements that are watched. We often serve as both scalpel and anesthesia. We confront lies and we bring comfort. We expose and we protect. We disrupt and we soothe. A tool is simply a device used to facilitate one's work. If I use a tool hastily or impatiently or roughly without care or skill, then I will do a botched job. If I have no vision for my work, then my use of the tool will be aimless. If I have no understanding of the substance with which I am working, I may scratch and gouge when I should sand lightly. If I am unaware of the strength of my arm, I will damage rather than draw out the hidden beauty. If I do not understand that different processes are called for at different times, I may use my voice when I should use my eyes. And if I do not grasp the limitations of my tool, I may try to use a screwdriver to do a hammer's job. There are two things that I have learned about the therapist as a tool. I've been confronted over and over again in these 25 years that as a tool, I am finite, limited. I cannot do everything. Now, sometimes I find myself limited on a very basic level. I don't even know what the work calls for. I'm staring at a job that needs to be done, and I am uncertain as to what use of the tool is necessary. Sometimes I'm limited because I know exactly what is needed, and I either do not have it or am afraid to try it. I am limited by time and space. I cannot be everything someone needs. I cannot be present every time someone wants me. I cannot give it all, be it all, do it all. I am unable sometimes to see clearly, to comfort adequately, or to understand fully. I can only be in one place at a time. I get tired, the needs are endless, my time, my wisdom, and my stamina are not. The second thing I've learned about the therapist as a tool is that though I am finite, I am a powerful tool. A look, a sharp word, impatience in manner, forgetfulness, selfishness, a hasty response due to arrogance, the small things that can reverberate through a client's life with staggering force. How easy it is for me to forget my importance to them. How quickly I forget that sometimes a life is lived from one session to the next. How easy for me to take my own words lightly and forget that they have power to hurt, to confuse, even destroy. When others come to us in the alarm moments of their lives, they lean hard. They feel fragile, they want us strong. They feel wobbly, they want us stable. They feel confused, they want us clear. They are vulnerable, and we sit in the chair of authority. The very act of sitting down in that chair underscores everything we say and do with power. If we thrive on that feeling of power, we will use others to feed ourselves. If we fear it, we may deny it or fail to use it wisely. The person who walks into an alarm moment of any kind and speaks from a position of authority has assumed an awesome responsibility for those whose lives have been thrown into chaos. Again, I would like you to stop and reflect. If what I'm describing is accurate, then you and I as counselors live in a very dangerous place. We live in a world that combines the things that humans most fear and turn from. We work with people who bring us the worst of themselves. We are in the context of this strange world and confronted with these difficult things, both limited in our effectiveness and powerful in our impact. It sounds like the description of a psychological minefield. Sounds sort of depressing, doesn't it? It certainly sounds like a crazy choice for a vocation. It sounds threatening. And if truth be told, it feels impossible. There are many who have found it so. And yet, after 25 years in this world, I can stand here and say that I love what I do. Now, you might think, after learning all of these things over the years, that my response would be, this is crazy. I have got to get out of here. And I will tell you, such thoughts do cross my mind now and again. But I have not run. And the reason that I have not run is because of the other lesson that I have learned in the therapist's chair, by far the most important lesson. I have learned that the nature of the work would frighten and overwhelm me. The nature of the people would sadden me and anger me and lead me to despair. And the nature of this particular therapist would result in calamities apart from one eternal truth. There is a Redeemer. I know this is so because I have met him and I have seen his work, and I am learning, oh so slowly, to be his student. Staying power in the alarm moments of hundreds of people's lives has been not only possible for me, but fruitful because of this Redeemer. Staying power means having the ability to endure. The word endure means to hold out against, to sustain without impairment, to bear with patience. If you and I are to sit with such things as ambiguity and silence and tears, if we are to come in contact with abuse and fear and rage, then we need a place to stay. We will give up without such a place, maybe not externally, but internally. I know many who give the appearance of care and comfort and of ears that hear but are dead inside. We end up impaired. We end up bitter, or cynical, or despairing. You see, we will be shaped by the things that our clients bring us, rather than by light and life and truth as found in Jesus Christ. We will fail to bear the burdens of others with patience. We will become impatient, or we will stand on the fringe of their suffering rather than being willing to truly enter it with them.
Well, we've come to the end of side one. I'm sure you're appreciating this tape as much as we have. Please take a moment and turn over to side two and stay with us as this incredible presentation continues.